Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Phil Coppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And in the run-up to Christmas, we are very fortunate that we are going to be joined by two extraordinary women, Normandy Ellis and Gloria Taylor Brown, who have just published and written a book called Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, The Initiatory Path of Spiritual Journaling. Because we are, as many people, I think, looking very much forward to spending some family quiet downtown around the Christmas period. And spiritual journaling is definitely something which comes across as being one of those pastimes where we quite often don't have time for during the year, but definitely where the Christmas period, with all of its good intentions, seems to be reconnecting ourselves with that kind of beautiful activity. So it's very good that we have these two beautiful women and also authors on our show. So Normandy and Gloria Taylor Brown, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Gloria, and I really appreciate your comments. And what, you know, it's kind of interesting. You said journey and journaling, and the truth is that in our book there are a number of journeys as well as opportunities to create journals.
Well, one of the things I wanted to start with on this, when I first picked up this book, I was fascinated by it because one of the things I think many of us have in common, and it was something that you say, I'm going to paraphrase you, Normandy, and you can correct me on your website, is that you love the world and you love the word. And I loved that that phrase. And I think that for many of us who are authors or aspiring authors, it is that passion for both writing and celebrating our journey in the world that really got to me. But John Anthony West has a quote on the back of your book as an endorsement for your book, which I loved. And he says, "It's not often that ancient Egypt inspires a truly original work, but this is one of those rarities." And that's what I, when I picked up this book and I started going through it, it's such a delightful book because there are surprises around every page. It's just one of those truly joyous things to not just read, but to experience. And it is truly an original work. So I'd love to know how the two of you originally got together to start working on this book.
Wow. Well, let's see. Gloria came to me with the idea of putting together a writing group, since I lead a lot of writing classes, of putting together a writing group on the Dahabiya, because she wanted the boat. And I had always wanted to be able to teach people how to use the Book of the Dead as their own spiritual text and as a way into the work. So the two ideas just seemed to come together right at the right time. And we had sign-ups before we knew it. That boat was full. We were very excited.
And Gloria, how did you come to this?
Well, I had wanted to, partly I had fallen in love with the Afandina, which was the Dahabeya. And I wanted to have it for as long as possible. So my thought was, well, if we're writing a book on it, we're going to get it for longer than just a 3-day cruise on the Nile. And I had basically wanted for some time, in fact, Normandy and I had both talked about the idea of creating a collaborative book, which is not what you would call a multi-author book where, you know, each author has one chapter and then the next author and the next author, but a collaborative book where everybody is writing throughout the entire book. And we weren't sure exactly how we were going to work this out and how to do this. So we came together with the idea that we would put this together and we would do this on the Nile, and that each person's contributions would be, basically added to the book as contributors, as opposed to, having a bunch of co-authors or something else like that. And Normandy had this fabulous program that she wanted to do, which was basically creating your own Book of Coming Forth by Light. And I thought that it would just be perfect for a cruise down the Nile, And of course, I love Egypt. I've been 10 times in the last 6 years. My husband says I watch the All Egypt All the Time channel.
Don't we all? you know, and for those of our listeners who are new to this subject, I want to say something and then I want to ask a question. The first thing is, Normandy Ellis, your translation of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, your book, Awakening Osiris, is a revelation. It is so beautiful. It's exquisite. It's poetry. It's moving and it's powerful. And it really has been a transformational book for so many people, including myself. So I'd like to just go backwards for, you know, some of our listeners are going to be familiar with your work and some of them are going to be new to it. And I think that your book, Awakening Osiris, belongs in the top 10 of everybody's spiritual and esoteric library. So everyone who's listening to this who does not know about this book, go out and get it. Normandy, can you just back up a little bit and talk about how you originally found yourself on this amazing journey?
Well, it's a strange and convoluted path that we often take into what becomes our own spiritual heritage. But the way it happened is that I had a friend who suggested very strongly, to the point of walking me over to the bookstore and putting my hand on the Book of the Dead. He said, "You need to read this book." This was a Rosicrucian man that I had grown up with. And I said, "Yes, fine, I'll buy it later." He said, "No, buy it now." I bought it. He subsequently brought me some of his library because he was leaving town and said, "Hang on to this." I did. He died. And those texts gathered a kind of a quality of energy, a vibration that wouldn't let me go. So when it became time for me, while I was getting my degree in English, to work in translation, I thought, well, here's a language that I want to learn. So I took Budge's book and a lot of subsequent translations and a good grammar dictionary, and I immersed myself for 10 years in this text. I just could not let it go, or else it could not let go of me. So, but I completely translated the book from the beginning to the end about 3 or 4 times. Whereupon my husband at the time thought that, I was going mad and it was best to get rid of the text. So I was driving to the dump to throw it in the trash one night when I look in my rearview mirror and, there's Robert sitting in the back seat of my car. And I thought, no, not really. So I kept driving. And whereupon he reached out and touched me, this man who had died, his spirit touched me and moved through me to the point that I realized, okay, this is real. I stopped the car. I look in the rearview mirror and I said, "Robert, don't ever do that again. You scared the devil out of me." And then he was gone. And I thought, oh, okay. So I kept the book in the trunk of my car where my then husband couldn't find it and be upset with me for working on it. And it was only about 2 months later when Fonis Press, David Fiedler from Fonis Press, wrote to me and said, "You wouldn't happen to have a book about these translations you've been working on, would you?" And that's how it came into being.
Well, I have read many, many versions of Egyptian writings, but I will tell you that I feel like I never really read them or saw them or felt them or understood them until I read your version. It is absolutely a revelation. So thank God.
Thank you.
You listened to Robert.
Yes.
But, you know, going back to the new book, Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, one of the things that I really love about it is it is so multidimensional. On the one hand, it is this journey book of the people who participated in this process. But on the other hand, it's a fabulously instructional book for those people who are new to this process. And I want to emphasize this, that you don't have to have a strong background in understanding these texts from ancient Egypt in order to get something incredibly valuable out of this book. So that's one of the things I wanted to talk about with both of you. Maybe Gloria, you can take this. I mean, what would you say to someone coming new to this subject, who's fascinated by it, who is, you know, really excited about writing about their spiritual journey. Because Philip and I also teach writing and do a lot of work with people who are really excited about writing about their spiritual journey. And they have a lot to say. And there's a lot of fantastic exercises in this book. But I would like to hear you address people who are coming new to the subject and explain to them why this Egyptian perspective is going to be helpful for them.
Well, one thing I want to say is that my belief is that it is incredibly important for us to record our journey, our journal, our spiritual autobiography, not just for ourselves, but for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And because, you know, I know the stories of my great-grandmother. I sat and listened to them at her feet. Most of the people I know can't even tell me where their great-grandmother came from. I know Normandy knows the stories of her family. And these are stories that have added dimension to my life in such a way that I'm able to build upon the information that has gone before. Whereas whenever all the information you have is that which is created by Disney or by Hollywood, you sort of have a skewed perspective of how people have survived and managed to get to this point. I believe that we have a responsibility to give this information to our descendants. One of the people that has read the book recently and commented on it was a woman who is in Arizona. And she says, I don't identify very well with the whole Egyptian thing, but I'm really interested in creating my spiritual journal for my grandchildren because I won't be around whenever they grow up. And so you can read this book on any level that you want. If you're totally enamored with Egypt, there's a lot of information on Egypt in there. If you've never experienced Egypt before, we've done our very best to give you good descriptions of the places we went. If you want to read it as a travel book, there is a travel book included in this because each one of our people wrote about one day of the tour from the perspective of the I Am, from the perspective of them seeing it. So throughout the book is a story which, if you read it, you'll realize it's changing authors, but it's still coming from the point of someone who is experiencing the tour. And in addition, of course, there's Normandy's wonderful lessons about how to create the spiritual journal. And then the examples which came from our contributors. And we had everything from people who had published multiple books to people who said they couldn't write on the tour. We had professional photographers on the tour who took beautiful photographs and are included in the book. And then more of them are included on the website.
And Gloria's beautiful meditations are also included in the book and her journeys, which we conducted through the temples. So there's that other aspect to it.
So you took these people to Egypt. First of all, had these people been to Egypt? Like, what was the percentage of people who had gone to Egypt before or novices? And, what kind of got the most powerful sites which they connected to, and was this a surprise to you, or are there like sites which you just know are going to connect to the writer?
Well, may I answer that? I think one of the things that happened right before the trip, and I think this was a moment of cohesion, is that my mother had died and we were all in the Temple of Isis when I released her ashes. And I think everyone who had experienced the loss of a parent was moved through that experience and was touched by Isis, by the power of Isis being there. Some of them had been on trips with us, one of us, or with others in the past. Some of them were active priestesses of Egyptian tradition. Others were very new to it. And so I think the blending actually works very well, because every person got something new, no matter where or on what level of the path they were on.
And so what is it you try to do? What is it that, do you just let people experience the site, or do you give information to them? How do you want them to approach these places of power?
Well, each place that we go to, we have a plan for what we are going to do when we get there, that we are going to have ceremony at this site, or that we are going to be going to particular temples at this site. Now, the issue with that is, in dealing with modern day Egypt, sometimes you don't get to do exactly what it is you thought you were going to get to do. You get there and you find out, no, you can't go into this temple, or you can't do something at that temple. And so you have to improvise. So some portion of it is always a little bit improvisational. But at the same time, we always know that we're going to be doing a certain ceremony, a certain group of ceremonies at different temples. In Dendera, we are always going to be doing something about Hathor. And at the Osirion, we are always going to be doing something about Osiris. In Elephantine, on the island, we are going to be doing something on Khnum. So we have those journeys, and those journeys have come through me, and the spirits speak through me as we go into those spaces. So sometimes I have no idea what I'm going to say. Sometimes it's been brought through ahead of time, and we have worked on it and figured out exactly what we want to do. But they are basically led through a series of ceremonial journeys. And then they're given time to, we always tried to do writing exercises at the temples themselves. We were successful. Oh, Normandy, I guess it was probably better than 50% of the time at doing a writing exercise at the temple.
Yes, amazingly so. We had enough time between tour groups where we would be able to find a quiet spot and go over and write for 10 or 15 minutes. And they learned to write right on the spot quickly, and really get down deep, because we had practiced that while we were in our circle on the boats. And there was a lot of teaching and sharing that went on the boat, to the point that we dubbed it the Afandina Floating University. It was a really lovely place. Yes.
Given that there were people on this journey from so many different backgrounds and experience levels. Some were writers. Some said they had never written and didn't consider themselves writers. Did you see any breakthroughs that you would like to talk about? I mean, certainly anonymously, you don't have to name anybody's name, but as facilitators of this journey, I'm sure it's extremely gratifying to watch these experiences unfold and watch the different people react to the spaces, not just personally and spiritually, but also in terms of their writing. And I was just wondering if you had any sort of specific examples or stories that you'd like to tell where one of these transformations really stands out for you.
Well, I'll tell you one that didn't make it into the book because it was impossible. And that was, there was a young Swedish woman who had studied in the Hawaiian tradition. And we asked people to talk about their inheritance, you know, where they came from. And many of them verbalized that. She was working in, you know, through the cover of another language. And so when she told her autobiography of where she had come from, she got up and danced it. I mean, there's no way to reproduce that. And everyone just was suddenly very moved by the fact that language was transcended. It was entering her body at that point. That's beautiful.
We're going to hold on for a minute. Gloria, are you online?
And in terms of the writing, I I think there were a number of people, one I remember who's very deeply psychic, who had gone through a difficult relationship. And the last time she had traveled to Egypt, she had traveled with her soon-to-be ex-husband. And so that was a different experience of Egypt for her, because she was seeing it as a single person and seeing it in terms of her own story as opposed to her reflection of his story. So I thought that was a very moving moment to see her gain her voice.
Gloria, did you want to add anything to that? Any story for you that stands out?
Well, one of our participants was a woman who, I don't know, who had been to Egypt with us a number of times. I think Denise has been there at least 6 times, maybe 7 times. And for her, it was interesting because she had 2 friends with her that she had talked into coming on this journey with her. And it was like they became something more than they had been before the trip. They ended up deciding that they were going to actually form a musical group called the Temple Sluts of Osiris. And they've actually performed, and it's available on YouTube as the Temple Sluts. And they were at that time living in several different places, and they've now moved to within a few miles of each other. And I just got a recent email that 2 of them had actually commissioned exact size statues, as the exact size of the Sekhmet statue from Karnak, to be carved and delivered to them from Java. And one of the things they're going to be doing is consecrating these statues in their new home as they set up a Sekhmet temple there. Mm-hmm. But this is all from this one trip where, you know, as a result of multiple trips, for Denise, that they were able to build this community almost out of this. And in a way, that was part of the book as well, was building community, because we are tremendously connected to the people who are on this trip. And we have other people who weren't on the trip, who've been with us to Egypt several times, who have regretted not being able to come on this trip with us and have lamented at numerous times that they didn't get to go on that trip, that they have, that was, you know, that was the one thing they would have wanted to do, and now they didn't, and now Normandy and I have to do another trip so that they can go.
Well, that was my next question, is are there more of these trips coming up in the future?
We were discussing one this morning. Normandy and Nikki will be returning to Egypt this year in November?
October.
And I will be returning to Egypt with Normandy in probably November of 2013.
And all of this information will be available on your various websites. We're going to put these up online for our listeners, but I do want to mention that there is a website for the book specifically, invokingthescribes.com, where they can go and read the first chapter of the book as well as some excerpts that did not make it into the book. And it's a great introduction. Also, you both have your own websites, normandyellis.com, and that's Normandy with an I, and GloriaTaylorBrown.com. And I am assuming that all your future trips will be posted on those websites, correct?
Yes.
And in terms of getting your books, Hathorsmirror.com is the great place to buy books on all things Egypt, correct?
Oh, yes.
Plus, on top of that, right now through the end of the year, there's a special where they can buy our book, Normandy and I's book, plus Normandy's Awakening Osiris, and Nikki's new book, Planetary Healing, as a package at a very reduced price. And I believe she has free shipping on that as well.
Still time to get great Christmas presents. I actually have several people on my list who are getting copies of these books, just so you know. Coming back to Invoking the Scribes, one of the things that immediately got my attention when I opened it in one of the early chapters is you talk about writing the hero's journey. And I think that using this idea of the hero's journey process for all new writers is just, it's such a rich and spirit-opening experience. And I wanted to know who is responsible for the hero's journey lesson in here that shows up on page 40 and 41, because I think it's really exceptional. And I think for all new writers who are trying to get into this concept of spiritual journaling, that this hero's journey process is a wonderful, wonderful place to start. And I'm wondering if either or both of you can talk about that.
Yeah, I started using the hero's journey actually with sixth graders when I was working as an artist in the schools. And we did pop-up books of Egypt, and we had to write stories about travels through Egypt. And I was moved to create this process that was a duplicate of the pharaoh Thutmose the IV and his story of sleeping beneath the shadow of the Sphinx. And it was connected with that whole idea of the Joseph Campbell myth of the Holy Grail. And so I felt that it was a place where everyone has a story. Everyone has moments of doubt. Everyone has places where they have to move through in faith. And the story of the Hebrews journey out of Egypt is another of those. And I've been using this exercise sort of as a continual prompt in many of my memoir writing classes that I teach here at Penhouse, where I live. And also, you know, as we were on the trip, I was really glad to be able to include it in the book, because I do think it's very transformative.
So going to Egypt, it's, I think to many is already a journey itself, but in Egypt you're beginning to make this journey. Do you see a correspondence between the modern person going to Egypt as a tourist and to some extent connecting with the gods and the scribes and everything of ancient times? Do you feel that they step into an old tradition? And if so, how do you see this correspondence between the modern world and the ancient world? Do you see it as something which is alive still, which is touchable? Is it more of stepping in the footsteps, but really with no connection? How do you see this?
Well, I would like to answer that, but I also think Gloria has something to say to that, so I'd like to let her go first.
For me, Egypt is alive with the spirit. And whenever anyone comes there, one of the first things that we always are, we're greeted at the airport with the words, "Welcome home." And truly, for at least for the Western tradition, Egypt is our home. It's where our great sciences, our great literature, our great knowledge began. Before Egypt, there was nothing. You know, there was tribal. And so it's like going back to your basic roots. And for me, the spirits of Egypt are as alive today as they ever were. I continually speak for Thoth and Ptah and Sekhmet and the powers of Egypt, and being invested with the powers of Egypt, I am allow them to move through me and out into the world. And there are other people, of course, that speak for them as well, because they're much greater than I could ever be. But that spirit is it's like touching the ephemeral, touching that peace that is God. Now, I'm not saying that these are necessarily God, but it is part of God. And it is the beginning of all the great Western religions. It is where they came from. Normandy can talk more about this, but, you know, the Ten Commandments is basically a bolderized, reduced version of the statements that you had to make as you entered the underworld in Egypt. It's written on the walls. Normandy, I've let you talk about that. But, you know, the idea that the Book of Psalms, much of the Book of Psalms is very, very, very similar to some of the writings from the temples. And so we know that this is where the knowledge came from. This is where the information was invested in us as human beings, where we moved to that next place where we could become something more than, you know, grubbing out there for bugs and chasing down lions or whatever it was we were eating for dinner, where we could become civilized beings. Normandy, I'm going to turn it over to you at that point.
Okay, thanks. That's a great way to look at it, Gloria. As you were speaking, I was thinking about the Hermetica, the tradition in which Thoth, Hermes Trismegistus, is speaking to the Greek philosophers and tells them that Egypt is made in the image of heaven. And so from that, we get the whole idea of as above, so below. One of the things that's so interesting to me about the landscape of Egypt is that the idea of the divine world, the natural world, began with the idea of the Neteru or nature, which the Greeks came to understand as nature. So God exists inside the green leafy things that grow. God exists inside that lion. God exists inside the Nile, inside the stars. And the other thing that really has impressed me is one of the reasons that Egypt holds so much charge for so many people, I believe, is because of the crystalline structure of the sands that surround it, because those crystals hold the vibrations of energy that has been, you know, placed upon this sacred land for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And it holds the structure of the light. It's very much a light culture. It holds the structure of the light and brings light into form there. And I believe that most of the stories, you know, the story on the wall, when you go into Karnak, you see these beautiful columns of lotus in which represent the beginning of the world, you know, and you hear stories of that are similar to in the beginning was the Word and the Word was God. That same story is Ptah opening his mouth at the beginning of the world and light springing from his lips. The Word and consciousness are all one part of the vibration that work together. And I think that's one of the beauties of the Egyptian mysteries is that they keep managing to unfold the more you look at them.
And they continue to be there. So I think in summary, you're actually saying that everything which is Egypt continues to speak to us. And Egypt clearly is a place where people are moved to journey and to journal, which maybe, you know, the two words are related not by accident, but by design. You also focus, I think, by the very nature of this book on some of the gods who are quite often forgotten, Thoth, or give him his Greek name, Hermes Trismegistus. Does he hold a specific fascination for you? What is it that brings him out, and specifically the writing aspect, which quite often isn't that prominent? Normally, you tend to see a focus on other deities, but not on Thoth. So what is captivating about this deity to you?
Of Thoth? He's been very much with me of late. I have another book coming out, which is called Imagining the World into Existence. And that pretty much, it comes out in August of next year, and that is his book. So I've spent a lot more time working with that energy. I think what's important about thought is that I don't want to say trickster energy, but I do want to say multiverse. Thoth speaks with us in a number of ways, through image, through sound, through story, through impression. And so I think that, you know, he is one of the oldest of the divine beings there. And as we begin to separate things out, we become perhaps more closely connected to a particular netter. I entered my internship in Egypt, shall we say, through Osiris and Isis, grew into relationship with Hathor and Horus and Sekhmet and Ptah, and am now growing into relationship with Thoth. So I think that it's just a way of unfolding. I think that any point is an entry point into the mystical tradition of Egypt. And as I say again, Thoth is the oldest.
I want to go back to a few things that you said in terms of Egypt and the homecoming, this whole idea of welcome home. I mean, for me, the first time I went to Egypt, I was so stunned by how completely at home I felt there. I went there expecting to be, completely foreign in so many ways to the culture. And when I arrived, I had that same powerful sense of welcome home. And I hear this so often from so many others who have the same experience. And the other experience that I have shared with you is that absolute knowing that each grain of sand in that desert contains light and energy. And when you're out there standing in it, you can feel it. You have that sense that every single crystalline grain of sand is holding on to something and preserving something that that we can access and that activates something within us. And so in that regard, I think that going to Egypt is a pilgrimage of humanity. I think that it's something that people should try to do at some stage in their lives, because it's one of those things that you can't explain to someone who hasn't been there. It is such an extraordinary and unique experience. So my question for both of you is, given the events of Egypt in the last year, the revolution, the turmoil, I know that some people are still very much afraid to visit Egypt. They think it's dangerous. What would you say to people who have a passion for it, a fascination with it, but are maybe afraid of the modern stigmas that are going on over there?
Go now. Yeah, because the truth is right now there are not as many people in Egypt. We have had Nikki Scully with Shamanic Journeys has had either three or four tours that she's coordinated in the last few months since the revolution, that have gone there. They have been welcomed. Everyone has been delighted to receive them. They've gotten into places they couldn't go other times. Nikki actually had a group over there with John Anthony West that was there at the time of the revolution.
And right, Nikki and I were there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They were in Tahrir Square when Mubarak stepped down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something 20 Americans will talk about for the rest of their lives. And they were safe.
Well, and I think, during the Arab Spring, Nikki and I took a trip there. And most of the trip, I have to say, is in Upper Egypt, and so we are not exactly in Tahrir Square most of the time. But the rest of the country, as Gloria so rightly said, is hungry and needs tourists to come there. You know, we're their, we are their bread and butter in a way. And, I feel that it's very important. You know, I don't normally tell people on my trips to go out and shop, because I'm not a materialistic person, but I said, please go out and shop. Please, please. Because these people could use a little of your support. And I mean, they did. It was wonderful to see how graciously, we were all welcomed as we traveled through Egypt. And we, like just one example that I'm thinking about, there was a moment where the boat, seemed to have run aground in an island in the Nile, and everyone was hustling off the boat carrying chairs and stuff, trying to lift the weight. And they told us we had to go off the boat too. So we go off the boat and they said, go stand in that mango grove. And we did. And there our lunch was spread out for us under the mango trees. And they laughed and they played music and they fed us. And it was the most, most lovely time that one could imagine there on the Nile, in the middle of, you know, what the rest of the world saw as a revolution, and we saw it as a revelation.
Absolutely. And on a side note, earlier this week we found out that there has been once again a new minister of antiquities for Egypt. The new head of the antiquities department is Professor Mohammed Ibrahim Ali. He's a person who I actually know. I've met him in 2008, and I always hoped that, and I always said that he was one of the two contenders after Dr. Zahi Hawass stepped down of taking the lead, and it has taken a few months for him to rise to that position. He's definitely open-minded. He, for example, was willing to attend the Bosnian Pyramid Conference in 2008, which, you know, the late Dr. Zahi Hawass, late because he is no longer in charge of these things, never wanted to even, you know, consider. He just went there, he spoke, he gave his opinions. He is very much a politician. He knows how to maneuver in these circles. He was the, or still is, I guess, the Dean of Archaeology for Ain Shams University. I remember him, me asking him how Dr. Zahi Hawass was at that time, and he said, you know, that he, the previous day before coming to Sarajevo, he had a meeting with him, and he said, I shouted at him, he shouted at me. It was the way these things always go. So he is a man who is able to stand up for himself, who doesn't just go and lay by the wayside as so many other Egyptologists did under the old regime. And so I hope that he continues to exercise his voice. But at the same time, as you're saying, it is a country which definitely in the Western media, a revolution in Egypt doesn't mean that there are grenades being thrown and that you will be shot at tomorrow. A revolution in Egypt literally means a large gathering of people who basically say that the government had to change, and, you know, that is what happened, and now it is back to business as usual. It is a country which has been tormented over the last decades, really, with foreigners either not coming or foreigners invading their country because they were felt to be not Arab enough, not Muslim enough, not fundamentalist enough. And there's a very moving story which happened, I think it was in 1997 when the terrorist attack happened on tourists, whereby basically the terrorists were foreigners. They had entered the country probably through the Libyan desert, and they hijacked, took hostages in a bus, and as soon as the local Egyptians knew about this hijack occurring, they were the ones who took to arms and basically said, we're going to kill these terrorists because what is happening there is just, you know, not good. This shouldn't be happening. And they were the ones who had the shootout with the terrorists who were unfortunately killing the tourists, because basically the fundamentalist wave which was going through the Arab world at that time, ahead of 9/11, basically was that Egypt wasn't Muslim, wasn't fundamentalist enough, and they were going to change this. And the way they were going to do this was to bring Egypt to its knees by basically making sure that no tourist was going to go there ever again, which was their hope, which obviously didn't work. But it worked for a period of 2 years. And again, Egypt, as everybody here has been saying, we interviewed Dr. Carmen Boulter a few weeks ago, as she has returned from Egypt. Basically, Egypt is safe. Go there, because it is not so much, I mean, apart from the fact that it is a beautiful country, your very soul needs to go to Egypt. So don't let Western media or just a general fear of the Arab world stop you from going to where your soul needs to take you?
And I think it's important that people realize that in a way, once you've been to Egypt, you never come completely back again. It's like a part of you becomes part of Egypt. It's sort of as though a piece of your soul becomes invested in that country. I've met no one who's ever been there who said that their feeling was that there was something more for them. Even people who've said to me, I'll never go there again. It's dirty, it's nasty, I don't like it. And that yet they say, I'm so glad I went because there was a piece of this that helped me find who I am. And also, I left a piece of me behind invested in that spirit, invested in that mind that is Egypt. I mean, in a way, it's like it is a mind of its own, that crystalline structure there. And when you stand beneath the chin of the Sphinx, it's like you are standing in the medulla oblongata of the brain, the mind of Egypt.
Absolutely true, and I have certainly felt that way many, many times. Gloria, I wanted to go back to you because we talked earlier about how Normandy got started on this journey. I wanted to go back a little bit to your history and how you got started, and then I also want to ask you, I saw something very interesting on your website about something you do called shamanic regression, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and tell us what that really means. But I'd like to go back to how this all started for you. Where did you find yourself on this extraordinary journey? How did it start?
It started when I was 5 years old and I read a book called Mara, Daughter of the Nile. And I went, it was an all words book, no pictures. And I read the book and I went home and I told my mother that I had found out where I came from and I wasn't her daughter. She wasn't thrilled with that. By the time I was 9 years old, I had read everything I could find on Egypt. I could recite the names of the pharaohs in order. Regretfully, since that time, the order has been changed because they found new pharaohs, and I don't remember it quite as well. But that was where my spiritual journey, my spiritual realization began, was in this fictional book that talked about Egypt. At that same time, my grandmother taught me how to read palms and how to do tarot. And so I was born into a family of psychics. And by the time I was 3 and 4 years old, I was having conversations with people that weren't there. So this had to be explained to me, and I had to understand where I was coming from with this. And I had to understand that not everybody was like this, and that it would be better if I didn't go out and share it with my friends. In fact, there was a long time where I never let anybody else know that how my connections were made. And the other thing that began was that I remembered my past lives. I remembered strongly having lived in Egypt. I remembered walking on the sands of Egypt. And I remembered walking through the gardens around the pyramids. I remembered wearing a long white gown. And this is whenever I was 5, 6, 7 years old, I could remember these things. And I always remembered those places as being just glorious, beautiful, painted buildings. And so for me, there's an overlay almost on modern day Egypt, which is the Egypt that was.
So
occasionally I have to watch myself because the ground level is different now. And I was thinking that I'm stepping on firm ground and it's another 2 inches down or 3 inches down. I mean, this physically. And so that's part of what I experienced. And one of the things that I realized as I grew older and I began studying about past lives and other people, that other people didn't have this access to their past lives, but that their past lives were basically affecting them, imprinting them, and creating, for some of them, some strong problems. And I began to do this, originally began as past life regression, and then I moved it into a point where it was more of a shamanic regression, where we go not only into past lives, but into life between life. The time when we make those contracts and make those agreements as we go forward, and we go in there and we look at the options we made and decide whether or not they're still valid contracts that we want to operate upon.
I'm listening to your story, and it sounds a little bit like some of the things that Dorothy Eady went through, the Aum Seti story, this awakening at a very, very young age and this realization that Egypt was a part of you.
Yeah, I didn't find out about Aum Seti until probably 10 years ago. And when I read her book, I was stunned because of the similarities.
Yeah, it feels very, very similar to me. Well, you two both have been on an extraordinary journey, and we are all the better for the books that you have written about it, including the newest one, which we've been talking about this hour, Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, The Initiatory Path of Spiritual Journey by Norm Journaling. We're both doing the journey and journaling thing, so there's definitely a strong connection between those words. Normandy Ellis and Gloria Taylor Brown, authors of, you can go to invokingthescribes.com if you want to read the first chapter, and we'll have all this information for you also up on the website.
But we are 367 days away from December 21st, 2012, which we started this show just under 2 years ago now. And really the idea was that we are living in a time where the spirit is revolutionizing itself into becoming something and transforming itself. It's why our show is called The Spirit Revolution. And so we want to ask a question for the next 52 episodes or so of The Spirit Revolution. And so Normandy and Glory, you are the first people who are going to be confronted with this question, which is very simple. What would you think, where you're going to be on December 21st, 2012? What is your perspective on what is happening in these days, in this time, and kind of how are you going to celebrate or feast this on December 21st, 2012?
Normandy?
Well, I am beginning in the year of 2012. I am creating on the land where I live a group of individuals raising consciousness. We are a part of what is called the Temple of the Sun, and we honor full moon and equinox, the quarters. So I will probably be on my land by the fire and working with the energies that are then going to be setting the course. As we go through this entire year, we're setting the course for where we are all going to be after 2012. The good news is that everyone's aware of what 2012 means, and they're all ready to wake up. Most people who say, oh, yes, are ready to wake up to it. The change can happen now because people are aware of it. And so it's my hope and my intent that I can become a part of that and continue through the next year.
I have no idea where I will physically be on December 21st, 2012. But I do know that I have been working on this transition that we are working on for over 12 years now. And then I was warned, and I warned the people who listened to my program, A Voice for Spirit, that beginning in 2007, we were going to be going through a really difficult transition period. And I have complained to Spirit about the fact that the transition period, which I expected to last for about 6 months to a year, has gone on much longer than I expected. And their response was that was my idea of how long it was going to take, not theirs. And that when I ask, you know, and this is a question I'm frequently asked in consultations, is what's going to happen at the end of 2012? And I've asked this of Thoth, and he's really clear about what's going to happen. He says 2013.
I like that answer.
Right.
He says, why do you think that we would be constrained by your artificial dating system?
Gods with an attitude. There are several of them.
We'll give Toth the last word here.
And it is the last word because we have come to the end of another edition of The Spirit Revolution. If you want to hear this episode or any other episode of The Spirit Revolution, again, there are a number of ways to do so. You can go to the BBS Radio Archives, where for a small fee, you can not just hear our show, but several other shows which are on the BBS Radio channels, either one or two. You can go to our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com, where you can listen to the last 5 episodes online. You can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/spiritrevolution, where we also archive and you can hear information or view information about upcoming guests or even ask them questions ahead of the interview. And there is also the beloved iTunes, where there is a year and a half of Spirit Revolutions archived and you can download them there for free. But we are heading towards Christmas and we will be seeing you just after Christmas. So from the both of us,
Merry Christmas.
And
the truth against the world.